Time for our Friday interviews. His alter ego, Mae McFetridge, he is one of Northern Ireland's best loved celebrities. But success came later in life for the comedian John Lenehan, whose showbiz career happened almost by accident. From mechanic to drag act at the age of 36, John himself admits that he has lived two lives. But he's all the more grateful after cheating death on more than one occasion. This year, we'll see John play Mae as the Panto Dame at Belfast Grand Opera House for an incredible 25th year in a row. It's astonishing, isn't it? I spoke to him earlier and he began by telling me how he got his break at the Opera House.
I was so surprised at even getting the first one because I was doing the warm-up on the Kelly Show and the Crankies were there as guests of Jerry because they were doing the pantomime and it was a regular thing. Anybody who was doing the pantomime then would have been a guest on the show. And the guy, the Crankies, saw me doing the warm-up and said, did you ever think of doing Dame and pantomime? I went, no, I'd never even been out of pantomime. And he says, yeah, I'll make a wee call. And thank God he did. He made a call and these people come over and saw me and the rest.
Because before that, if we actually rewind to before that, you started off life as a mechanic, didn't you?
Motor mechanic, yeah. Dick's Garage in Donegal Street. Old Clark Hewson, God rest him, gave me a job when I was 15 and I was there until I was 22 years of age.
Did you like it?
Oh, loved it, yeah. Loved the cars. Like, I couldn't screw a nut on a bolt, like, when I started. Like, I wouldn't have had a notion. Like, our family didn't even have a car, you know. Yeah. Two pushbacks in the house, I think that was it.
And the story goes that part of you getting your break was with Eamon Holmes ringing into his programme. Is that right? Was he in downtown at the time or what?
Yeah, he was working for BBC doing a magazine programme called Open Air in Manchester. And it was, you know, like something like This Morning. And then he got the summer off and downtown asked him, would he do a couple of weeks? And he said yes. And then he asked me, he said, John, would you ring in, like be a critic of the show or, you know, slag me off or do what you do at family weddings or funerals and family parties, just whatever you want. And I went, like, Eamon, I don't know, like, you know, how long is it going to be for? He said, 5 minutes. I said, live for 5 minutes? What am I going to say for 5 minutes? And I nearly didn't do it.
Wow.
But only because it was just because I promised him, you know, and I wouldn't break my promise. So, and it was really, you know, the night before on the Sunday night, I was, you know, should I, will I, won't I? But I just said, all right, we'll ring in. It was 10 to 11 or something in the morning, and that was it.
Can you remember ringing in and what you said?
I was talking about, I think it was the £10 grant that the pensioners were getting coming up to Christmas, or a heating grant or something like that, and it wasn't enough, and I says, disgraceful, like, us wee women, it's not right that we're only getting such and such. And it was all issues of the day, you know, should this happen, should that happen, and I was just, you know, I was just shouting for the punters, you know, and making me, you know, we quips about where I lived and where you get the best fries and where you get your bread and your sodas and your pops and everything, you know. And it was just all about, you know, what pensioners should be getting and should not be getting.
And it went so well that did you know that you were on to something instantly or did others have to tell you?
No, I didn't. I thought it would have lasted a month or maybe 2 months. But Eamon Holmes said to me at the end of the first week, he says, John, I think you could take this and you could get paid employment until such times as you give it up or if you die. He says, I think you can get this for the rest of your life, some sort of, you know, work at this. And I says, ah, yeah, you ho.
So, John, what happened from there then? You're told by Eamon you could make it.
Yeah.
But it's still a big thing to launch yourself into that type of attempt at a career?
Yeah, well, after it finished, you know, it was all the talk of North Belfast, did you hear the wee woman and blah, blah. Next thing, the Irish News, a wee girl called Pauline Reynolds, she was a reporter, and she heard it was me, and I had known the Reynolds family. And she came up to do a piece, and then we wanted to be taking a photograph. So I went over to my mother, and God rest her, and I said, I knew she had a lovely wee grey wig and a hat. I don't know why she had a grey wig, because she had a lovely head of silver hair anyway. And I got one of her outfits, you know, big cardigan, and put it. She says, well, what's it for? I says, a wee photograph. And I says, here, there's a wee woman from North Belfast. She's on the phone with Eamon Holmes. Have you heard her? He says, mad's me. Oh my God.
My mummy and daddy loved me. My mummy wanted a wee girl, my daddy wanted a wee boy. Two of them are delighted. But don't you be laughing, love, at least I can change. Anyway,
so we got the photograph taken, and that was her started. And it was about 2 weeks after that that John Daly had heard me, and John was a DJ, obviously, with Downtown Radio, and he asked me, would I ring into him? And it just went on, and I did. It's a John show for maybe 3-4 years or so.
Kurt, I'm just looking at you at the front. You just remind me of Patricia, Josie, and Phyllis. Although, in fairness, it wouldn't be as hard looking as you three. Do you know you can get a clothing grant, love?
It's incredible how something like that starts off small, and yeah, then you feel the snowball effect,
yeah,
don't you? Were you frightened when you realised that it was getting big, or actually did you just lap it up?
No, I really lapped it up. I wasn't, to be honest, I wasn't afraid of anything, because I'd had a couple of things, as you said, you know, like 2 years before I started that, I had a head operation, you know, neurological problem. They opened up the back of my head, and I contacted meningitis. And at one stage, I was given 36 hours to live.
Let me ask you about that. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Syringomyelia?
Syringomyelia.
And what is it?
Syringomyelia is, the way I explain it is MS is when the sheath around the nerves on the spinal cord disintegrates. That leaves you with multiple sclerosis. Syringomyelia is when there's liquid bubbles form on the sheath, and they swell, and when they swell, if they touch the bone, it's where all the electric pulses go down, you know, through the nerve ends, and if that touches anything, it's like putting a screwdriver across a wire, you know, or a HT lead in a car, you know, you break the circuit, you know, and then there's no pulses go to that area. So the area T11 in my body, which is sort of my shoulder, left arm, down to about stomach level, and that whole side, I have no feeling of pain. I have muscle wastage in that side, and it's the type of thing that will either gallop or crawl. Lucky enough, mine's crawling, and it is getting worse, but it's at a very, very slow rate. And because it's at a slow rate, I can sort of adapt, you know, to different things. Should you be lifting, you know, a tray, or should you be lifting, you know, I could hardly lift a pint with my left hand, you know.
But they told you at the time that your life was at risk.
Yeah, well, I when I contacted the meningitis, I was anointed, and I had 36 hours to live. They said it could go either way, but God didn't want me, and the devil's afraid of me.
Well, that's a life-defining moment, John. Did it change your attitude to life?
Oh, totally, absolutely. I just love life. Really appreciate my wife and my two girls and my grandson now, and, you know, I just love life, and I love every day. You wake up, you throw the elbows out, there's no wood, happy days, we're laughing, and it doesn't matter, you know, people, that's a terrible day, it's raining, get out and get soaked, it's beautiful.
And do you genuinely, have you been able to genuinely hold on to that feeling? Because you get
totally
a shock, and okay, then you feel lucky to be alive, but after a while, do you not then fall into the...
No.
The rat race, like the rest of us.
No. And the job I'm doing, you know, I think God's been very, very good. The job I'm doing, I love doing it. And people, well, most of the people like it. And they're very appreciative. And I have got a lovely, comfortable living, you know. I don't want to be a millionaire. If the money comes along, that's fine. If it doesn't come along, that's fine as well. All you need, and this is really right across the board for everybody and anybody listening, all you need is enough. See, if you have enough, and you can get out in the morning and see the trees and smell the grass, and you're good. And all right, I wouldn't be the fittest person in the world, but you know, I can go out and play my golf, and you're a multi-millionaire.
Although you say you don't want to be a millionaire, but I guess when you look these days at the success across the water of the likes of Brendan O'Carroll, Mrs. Really? Brown's boys.
Yeah.
Is there not part of you thinking that could have been me?
Actually, I was at a funeral yesterday and a woman came up to me and says, listen, I think you're funnier than Brendan O'Carroll. You could have done that. And I went, listen, you have to be driven for that, you know what I mean? And what I was doing and what I am doing, you know, I get enough, you know. That's why I do charity work, you know. You don't have to be getting money, you know, 7 days a week, you know. And if you can give, I believe you get it back tenfold.
But there's no part of you, John, even beyond the money element of it, wondering what the success would have been like across the water.
Yeah, you can wonder that, you know. But see, to be honest, see, when you've hit the bar a couple of times, and like in the early 70s, me and my wife, we were caught up in a no-warning bomb. And we fell from a lounge upstairs onto the ground floor of a bar. From the lounge, we took a scenic route straight down. And we were trailed out of that. I remember seeing her face. I could see her cheekbones sticking out. I could see the white of her skull. My nose dropped. I thought I'd lost my left eye. The treasure legs were blown clean off my body. And, you know, I look at that, and then I look at when I was in the hospital, when I got anointed, when I was given 36 hours, I had the meningitis, I thought I was going to die. I wasn't worried what it was like to be a movie star or anything like that. You know what I mean? You have different things to worry about. And I know what you're saying, you know, like when that all dies down and, you know, yeah, Mrs. Brown, brilliant, Brendan O'Carroll, lovely, lovely man. But I don't think I could be up for that, you know what I mean? I don't think I'm good enough for a start, like.
Well, you see, isn't that interesting in itself? Because to do what you do, you know, to rip the arse out of other people in terms of comedy, you know, the majority of people would think that you have to have an incredible amount of self-confidence and self-esteem. You know, in what I do in the radio, people think I've got a lot of self-confidence. Actually, I'm not too sure I do. And I just noticed what you said there. You don't think you're good enough. Well, that'll shock people.
He has his whole family with him, you know, and that's a big, big thing, you know. Like, I have one of my daughters, if I asked her to go on live television, in 10 minutes she would be ready. See, the wife and the other daughter would run a mile.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he has a family there that, you know, yeah, we'll go for it, and they're all up for it, and brilliant, and, you know, and he keeps it all in, and it's all the family getting their wages, and that's great, you know what I mean? That's a big plus for him, and I think that's what's made it so good. Mrs. Brown's boys, you know, that they're all family and they all know each other and they just bounce off each other superbly.
You happened to mention there, again, what you got caught up in, a couple of incidents during the Troubles, mm-hmm. but one of them was a gunfight you were caught in the middle of, wasn't it?
I was walking down the Antrim Road one Sunday, lovely sunny day, and Land Rover company. It was one of the open top Land Rovers from very early on in the Troubles. And next thing, there was bang, 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 bang. You know, the Provisional IRA opened up on the soldiers, and two bullets clean over the top of my head. And I saw one of the soldiers falling out of the back. He had been hit in the shoulder, and he was lying on the ground. And I turned around to say to Brenda, "Look, run." But I looked, and she was halfway up the Antrim Road. She'd left me. And there was two shots went over our head and then to the front room of a house beside us. You know, and between that and then the bomb we were in, and that's it, I'd had enough. We moved to Dublin for 4 years.
So you got out?
Yeah.
Because you were frightened of living where you were, or...?
I just couldn't hack it anymore, you know. You're walking, you're going to work, and you maybe stop three times. If I stopped walking down to work, I lived on the Cafel Road, I'd walk down to work to Donegal Street. You maybe could stop three or four times, you know, getting your paycheck, you know, and you stand against the wall. And I said, do we really need it? And then the ball, and I'd put the cap on it, because Brenda's father, God rest him, he was a Dublin man, and they were moving to Dublin, and my mother was moving to New Zealand. Like, well, everybody's leaving me, you know, so I went to Dublin and got married and all there.
And when, John, you get stopped like that so many times, did that give you a sense, as it had the others, of discrimination to the point where you started to despise the British?
Oh, no, no, absolutely not. It was just, you know, It was a nightmare every time. Look, lads, I've told the people on up the street there, I've told them exactly what I'm telling you. Look, just that's enough, you know. And it's over here, and that's what they're doing. That was what we grew up with, and, you know, that was just part of life, you know.
What made you come back then?
In 1978, it seemed to get a wee bit quieter, and I was living in Dublin, and we had our first child, and we were only in a flat in Dublin, South Dublin, and it just wasn't right, and we were only renting it. And then you needed a massive deposit of a house, and we just hadn't got it. But I had enough money to come back and buy a house cash in Belfast. That was the difference. I had enough for a deposit in Dublin, but I had enough to buy one cash here.
Which shows you the difference, doesn't it, in the economies.
But it was the best thing ever I did, you know. It totally changed, me moving back totally changed my life with, you know, him and et cetera.
Do you think May has a shelf life?
I think May just gets older as I get older, and she gets, I think she's starting to get sharper. You know, because she knows, she's seen it all. She's heard every one-liner that's been thrown at her.
Is that your wife? Second wife, put them in my first choice, I dare tell you. No! Well! Thank you. You crack all the jokes you want, son, they're paying me. Nice!
Well, I suppose it's like everything else, it'll run. But I thought it would have run out in 3 months. And we're now getting into the 27th year.
Yeah.
The 27th year.
And pantomime, I was saying at the start of this, the panto, this will be your 25th year in a row at the Grand Opera House.
Yeah, 25 years in a row, my goodness.
It's hard work though, isn't it? It's intense.
Yeah, you know, I remember the first time I did the pantomime, and Gene Fitzpatrick had done it 2 years previous with Frank Carson. He says, John, he says, you'll do one, but you'll never do another one. He says, it's the hardest thing ever. I think it was just the two a day and 6 days a week. I think then on a Saturday, I remember us on a Saturday doing three shows. And I always said, promised myself after the first Saturday we did it, that I would never do any ad-libbing on the first show or the second show. We'll keep the ad-libbing for the last show, because purely of the fact that I would say to myself, now, did I say that 2 hours ago, or did I say that an hour and a half ago? You know, did I say it at the start of this show, or did I say it at the end of the last show? And what the last thing you want to do is repeat yourself. So what I did is kept all the ad-libbing for the last show.
And have the audiences changed in the way they react to your comedy? You know, can you be riskier these days or less risky?
There's stuff there like the double entendres. You can keep that sort of, you wouldn't do it in Matney when there's 900 school kids, because they just obviously wouldn't get it. But I don't do anything, you know, nothing even near the knuckle. I wouldn't even go, you know, that far.
Why not?
It's just not my comedy. Even like back to Mrs. Brown again, you know, his language, like I would never, ever, ever use it. You know, as May, you know, the F word she can come out. And it's funny, you know, and it's grand, you know, but, you know, I know there's 7 and 8 year olds that watch Mrs. Brown and love him, you know, and love her. And, you know, like if you'd have heard that when I was a child, the mother would turn televisions off. That's disgraceful. That's just then, and you know all this. But I suppose you can get away with it, you know, a lot now. But still, I wouldn't be comfortable.
Fella goes into the bar, says the barman, "Give me and my giraffe a drink." says, what's it want? Says, give me a pint and give it a pint. So they necked it. Then they necked it, and then had two more pints. And next thing, two more pints. Then about 12 pints later, the big giraffe just collapsed. Your man's walking out the door, and the barman says, hey, you're not going to leave that land there, are ye? Says, that's not a land, that's a giraffe.
What about for someone that's been in the business for so long, how do you compare TV and the entertainment industry these days to what it was? Do you think we've kind of lost the...
Yeah, totally. Totally. Like, there's no... On a Friday night, you had the Kelly Show, or the BBC had the John Daly Show, the Gerry Anderson Show, or whatever, you know, where the local talent, you know, got a chance. And I was lucky enough, I got my chance, and I've worked on that, and fine. But there's young talent coming up now, even singers. Like, you look at that wee Andrea Begley.
Yeah.
She had to go to The Voice. She had to go to the mainland, as they say, to be heard. Like, if that wee girl, if it had been a television show for her. And I think there's a massive market for it still.
Yeah.
You know, should the BBC or UTV, you know,
bring back an entertainment show, a chat show.
Absolutely. Why not? Like, you know, you'd be ideal for the lack of that, you know, although you do a lot of hard-hitting stuff, you know, and that's fine. But, you know, I think there's a gap there for an entertainment show, as you say, where you have, you know, good bands on. Some of the greatest bands I've ever heard are from here. You know, beautiful singers and, you know, they're like a Peter Corey who started with that baby show, what was it, Let Me Entertain You, or
yeah,
whatever it was called. And there's Peter Curry. It was
called Go For It.
That's correct. And he was in the West End as Jean Valjean and one of the greatest musicals ever, you know, and he's in the West End, you know, and he's worldwide now. He's in America, Germany, Holland every year, you know, and he's massive. Peter Curry's massive. But if it hadn't been for Go For It, you know what I mean? And there are many other Peter Corries are out there.
It's something I sometimes say on the radio, that if you look for Northern Ireland to be a relatively small place, mm-hmm, if you look at the number of success stories that there are, okay, fair enough, on the network or whatever, mm-hmm, Northern Ireland hasn't done too badly. You know, from Gloria to Eamon.
Absolutely.
In terms of the presentation, to sport,
yeah,
obviously you've got Rory and Graham. And
Rory, Graham at all, you know,
Barry McGuigan, you have loads of them.
And this wee lad Frampton, he's up there, wee Paddy Barnes, who's still an amateur. But, you know, worldwide, they love him. And Carl Frampton will be world champion,
yeah,
you know. And with McGuigan right behind him. Like, you know, you could fill the first year of a BBC or UTV entertainment show with just sport alone, you know what I mean?
So what's next then, finally, John, for you? Just same as? Continue on?
Yeah,
are you slowing down any, or are you just...
Well, I don't do as much now during the year. Like, you get the pantos there and you can get it sorted and, you know, and I do weddings and stuff here and there. And it's grand, you know what I mean? It's like I said, all you need's enough. Okay, when the rates bill come in, I still worry about bills and all. And there's sometimes when the taxes due, you know, you're end of July and the end of January, and sometimes you have to wait and hope it's going to be there, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, things are good and life's great, you know, and I'm just delighted to be still doing it.
Well, you're a very funny man, John, and you're one of us, and it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Listen, and loved you, and give your mother all my best. I remember doing her birthday.
You certainly did, and you had the place in raptures, and you did a fantastic job. She still talks about it. John, thanks very much.
Listen, thank you, Stephen.
All the best. Bye bye.
Cheers, man. The biggest show in the country.
The Stephen Nolan Show. Morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, you were talking to John there, and yeah, he told you about the day he played. He was on Downtown Radio on Eamon Show.
Yeah.
Eamon asked me at that stage to listen in to John, to have a little listen in.
Did he?
Yeah, and afterwards he phoned me and he says, well, what do you think? And I says, Eamon, it's one of the most unfunny things I have ever heard in all my life.